listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I've been sitting in the green room with Scotty McLennan and Jim Berklow, and they're just two terrific human beings. I think it's going to be a wonderful conversation tonight. After they have a conversation, they will open it up to you for questions. The Reverend William L. McLennan, Jr., is better known as Scotty McLennan, is an ordained minister, lawyer, and author. Since January 1st, 2001, he's been the Dean for Religious Life at Stanford University, where he oversees religious affairs on campus, is the minister of the Stanford Memorial Church, and teaches undergraduate and graduate School of Business courses. He is the author of Jesus Was a Liberal, Reclaiming Christianity for All, which he and Jim Berklow will be discussing tonight, in which he advocates a Christianity based on the humanity behind Christ's teaching. He is also the author of Finding Your Religion, When the Faith You Grew Up With Has Lost Its Meaning, and co-author with Laura Nash of Church on Sunday, Work on Monday, The Challenge of Fusing Christian Values with Business. He earned both his Master of Divinity and his Juris Doctor degrees from Harvard's Divinity and Law School, and was ordained in 1975 as a Unitarian Universalist Christian minister the same year that he was admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. After practicing church-sponsored poverty law in a low-income neighborhood of Boston for a decade and founding the Unitarian Universalist Legal Ministry, he was appointed university chaplain at Tufts University. He's been awarded many awards. Among them, he was the recipient of the Rabbi Martin Katzenstein Award, the oldest annual award given to Harvard Divinity alumni, to honor among its graduates one who exhibits a passionate and helpful interest in the lives of other people. He was also honored with the Gandhi King Ikeda Award in 2004. And he was also, one of his claims to fame, among many, was the inspiration for Doonesbury's Reverend Scott Sloan. Reverend Jim Berklow, who will be in conversation with Scotty tonight, is an ordained United Church of Christ congregational minister. He's served as the Associate Dean of Religious Life at USC since August 2008. He creates and conducts groups, events, and programs for students to experience the religious and spiritual diversity of USC and Los Angeles. And he and Scotty were comparing the number of religious groups they have on campus. It's quite interesting. He'll want to talk to you about that. He was the founder and executive director of the Urban Ministry of Palo Alto, which serves low-income and homeless people in the peninsula area of Northern California. And he writes and speaks extensively at a national level on theologically and socially progressive Christian topics. He is the author of two books on progressive Christianity, Open Christianity and Birdlike and Barnless. With no further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Scotty McLennan and Reverend Jim Berklow to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Well, this is a lot of fun for me, for us, I think, to be back
definitely
together.
Definitely, for me.
And to welcome Scotty to L.A. I spent a number of years working under him at Stanford. I was the Protestant campus minister there, ecumenical Protestant pastor, and he was my boss and effectively my supervisor. And it was just a joy to work with this very humble and warm and kind and available pastor to our students at Stanford, and a very inspirational pastor at that, at a very personal level, but also in terms of his impact on our campus community. So it's really great to have you here and to be in this role with you.
Fabulous to be here with you, Jim. I really appreciate it. And this is the man who wrote, I think you heard, the book Open Christianity, which led me in this direction even before I got to Stanford. So I'm very appreciative to have this conversation with you tonight.
Yeah. And super fun to get this book when it came out last year and read it over and see parts of Scotty I didn't know. I learned more about you from the book. And I think the first thing that I learned is just how serious you are about the word liberal. And I thought it might be a really good way to start. For one thing, we should find out how comfy you are with the title of this book in this day and age, particularly this week,
right,
in America.
Right.
What makes you a liberal? What makes you serious about this term that so many people have given up or avoided and translated into other terms?
I want this word back. It's been hard to use this word politically. It's been hard to use this word religiously. It's a wonderful word. It has a sense of tolerance and openness, of freedom, a progressive vision of seeing the world as going somewhere. It has a very positive understanding of human beings, not saddled with original sin, but having the potential for good. Obviously, we are caught between our good and evil sides always, but it emphasizes the positive. And it's a word that has meant beneficent and open and caring and so on. So it's a word that I want back.
All right. Well, one aspect that, you know, one part of your life that helped explain it for me when I saw the title that you finally got here on the book. I don't know if you totally chose it yourself, but
there was some dialogue with the publishers over this particular title. It was not my original title, but I own it and claim it now.
Yeah, well, it almost sounds like because it became the title, you claim it even more, would you say? Is that true?
Yeah. No, and I certainly see myself as a religious liberal, as a Christian liberal, and talked a lot about it in the text, but my original title was a little more boring, so I'm glad that they have a slightly more provocative title for the book.
Well, as a Unitarian, the word liberal in that context of your denomination, I guess, is one that's still very much alive and well. Isn't that
right,
part of your tradition?
No, Unitarian Universalists consider themselves as very much involved in liberal religion, and we do use that term. And it was a term that, when I was looking at Unitarian Universalism when I was in college in the 1960s, attracted me to the denomination, that they would say explicitly, this is liberal religion. However, at that time, I must say, Gary Trudeau wrote on the cover of this book that this is a powerful and reasoned argument that it's time for liberals to reclaim ownership of Christ as he was. And then Gary calls him an outlier, a passionate but rationalist revolutionary. So I do have a lot of friends who are saying, Jesus was a liberal. He was a radical. This is much too tame a word.
So. Well, part of the book gets into the story of how you got to the point of becoming a Unitarian pastor. And I love the story about your spiritual journey, your path into spirituality, particularly the part about your experience in India and how that shaped your perspective.
Well, maybe it would be helpful just so that the audience can get a little bit of a flavor of the book if I read just a little bit about
That particular one would be great.
So there's a chapter here near the beginning of the book where I speak of some liberal perspectives, how a liberal Christian looks at religion. And I say, starting off, a perspective on Jesus, a Hindu priest with whom I spent a college-era summer in India used to speak of avatars. And by the way, that word avatar has totally changed. It used to avatar used to mean an incarnation of God. So anyway, used to speak of avatars, people with clear mystical awareness who have direct knowledge of the infinite spirit that infuses the universe. In other words, they have true God consciousness. Avatars, he said, help the rest of us see what God is like in human form. They're sons or daughters of God in a uniquely pure way. The priest's avatar was Ramakrishna, a 19th century saint who inspired an order and mission in India that's come to be known in America as the Vedanta Society. At the end of the summer, when I expressed a strong interest in becoming a Hindu, the Hindu priest said, no. Ramakrishna, he said, taught that avatars have had different impacts from culture to culture and era to era. Yet ultimately, although they use different names and different religious methodologies, they all point to the same God. So Ramakrishna advised seekers not to look outside their own tradition, but follow the path they know best with wholehearted devotion. Ramakrishna counseled a Christian should follow Christianity, a Muslim should follow Islam, etc. The priest directed me back to the Christianity with which I'd grown up. He insisted that Jesus was my avatar, not Ramakrishna, nor the Buddha, nor anyone else. It was in Jesus' footsteps that I should walk to know God better. That didn't mean that I should bring along all my prior assumptions about Jesus being the only way to God for all people. I needed to develop a wider view of Christianity that included respect not only for other religions, but also for everything I'd come to know scientifically, logically, and rationally. When I returned to the United States, I discovered and joined the Unitarian Universalist denomination, rooted in liberal Christianity. It's wide open to the religions of the world, as well as to those who do not accept the label religious. In seminary, I learned about this sermon that Unitarian minister Ralph Waldo Emerson had preached in 1938 to the graduates of the Harvard Divinity School, and Jesus' role as avatar came through loud and clear in that magnificent address. I got to go on in that vein.
So another aspect of your story is that you've claimed Christianity coming out of that experience, but you're in a denomination where Christians are a minority group. So I guess you have some experience of being a minority within a denomination that's a minority, and being a progressive Christian or a liberal Christian is a sort of a minority experience. So what's it like being a Christian in the Unitarian denomination?
It's interesting that Thomas Jefferson was one of four United States presidents who've been Unitarian in our history. And he said that all of America would be Unitarian within a generation. We've never been more than 0.1%
That's nation. Great.
So, yes, we're a minority religion. And within it, there's about 20% of us who affirm ourselves as Christian. And many of us who would say we're humanist or agnostic or atheist, but also many of us who would say we're Buddhist Unitarian Universalists or we're Hindu or Muslim and Jewish and so on, or we're involved in pagan or Wiccan or a number of traditions. So one of the beauties of Unitarian Universalism is it's wide open, it's a non-creedal tradition. And I love it because we have an opportunity to, within our churches, really have the kind of pluralism and discussions, interfaith discussions within our own church that I ultimately would hope for the world. So for me as a Christian, sometimes in a difficult position because a lot of Unitarian Universalists have left Christianity to find this kind of openness and sometimes associate Christianity with its more conservative forms, which can feel close-minded or feel doctrinal or dogmatic. It's sometimes difficult to affirm the kind of Christianity, liberal Christianity, that I believe in, but it's been a wonderful number of years for me ever since college, being a Unitarian Universalist.
Yeah, great. Well, another part of your journey is coming to an understanding of God. I mean, let's start with the basics here, okay? If we're going to get into Jesus being a liberal, maybe we should have a little chat about what you mean when you talk about God, and you talk about Einstein's God. And I know when you started, I remember you telling me about the origin of this book coming out of discussions with the big four public atheists, right? Dennett, Dawkins, Harris, and
Hitchens.
Hitchens, thank you. Hitchens. The other H, yes, right. And the team.
Right.
And your who was it? I think it was Dawkins, was it not? No, it was Dennett is the one who said it's a great, it's high treason to claim that that you can believe in a God at all, much less believe in one that's supernatural, but it's still high treason even to believe in a God that's Einstein's God. So how do you negotiate that?
You know, actually, it was Richard Dawkins, now that you mentioned it, in his God...
Dawkins, okay.
In the God delusion.
Yeah.
And he didn't like people like me who are not supernaturalists, who see God as part of the natural world and have what he would say a very impersonal notion of God, not one of a puppeteer God that intervenes in history and sometimes changes natural laws and so on through miracles. So he said, well, if you don't believe in that kind of God, you really can't claim that that's God, and it's intellectual high treason. So for me, what happened with God was I found myself very much in the position, I think, a lot of the neo-atheists through high school, where I came to believe that there couldn't possibly be a God in the world because of all the horrible things that go on. Some of that was explainable by what people do to people, but what about the so-called acts of God? What's just happened in Haiti? You know, what do you do about earthquakes and hurricanes and tornadoes and the death of innocent children and so on, the suffering that goes on? So I basically had come to a point in my own life as I entered college where, having grown up as quite a conservative Presbyterian Christian in the Midwest, and when I got to Yale in 1966, I had basically decided there couldn't possibly be a God. And there was a chaplain at the time, William Sloan Coffin, who had a what he called a seminar for friendly disbelievers. And I thought, well, gee, that's me. I'm a disbeliever, but I'm still moderately friendly because I think these are important existential questions. And so this was an opportunity for me to, in college, have a number of experiences both with him and out doing social action, anti-war work, civil rights work, but and visit going to India, as I did the summer after my freshman year, but also an intellectual experience in a number of courses where I came to add what I would call signals of transcendence or little hints of transcendence on top of my atheism. So the first was mathematical infinity. I got very interested
which is in the book. Yeah.
So I have a section here about God as the infinite, and that, you know, we use this notion in infinity and calculus, you know, run n to infinity if we're going to build bridges and so on. We assume that asymptotes, we have, ultimately reach lines, and that's an important concept. And so the more I got interested in infinity and in theorists of infinity like George Cantor's theory of transfinite numbers, I began to feel, okay, maybe there's something there about infinity. And then I got quite interested in Einstein and in physics in terms of natural laws of the universe, and that there's something, this universe holds ultimately. It's not Orion askew. There are discoverable natural laws that are consistent across the board. So again, this notion that somehow not only is infinity a useful concept, but there are significant natural laws in the universe. And I also got interested in religious mysticism, in people like Aldous Huxley writing Doors of Perception and a lot of mystical movements at the time, people learning meditation techniques and yoga and so on, and began to think maybe there's something there in us that religious people have been talking about for millennia that also has to do not with a personal God maybe, but with a sense of a spirit or a force in the universe, an energy that we can connect with. And then ultimately I also felt that on the human level, as I got more interested in Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. and nonviolence, as I was doing my social activism, that really ultimately the human law, if you will, the natural law of human life is love. And that obviously we are hateful beings in many ways, but at our best we're loving, and that kind of love is really well exemplified by Jesus. And this is somebody who's taught us how to be loving, not just of our neighbors, but even of our enemies, and how to turn the other cheek, and how to have this radical concern for those who are alienated and marginalized in society. So I put those four pieces together and ultimately came out of college being able to say that, yes, there is a God, and these are the contours of God for me.
I was, when I read the part about infinity, I got very excited because it reminded my own stories. The moment I decided to go to seminary, I don't know if I ever shared this with you, was taking calculus and just dealing with this whole concept of the limit, you know, getting arbitrarily close to the limit. And I just went into a sublime ecstasy in calculus class. And afterwards I thought, if I'm having a sublime ecstasy about the spirituality of the limit, I think I probably belong in a seminary.
Exactly.
Instead of another different kind of, so yeah, it's just interesting that we would get there. Yeah,
exactly. And I wrote a senior thesis in college called Computers and Infinity.
Oh, really? Ooh.
Because I got very interested in the logical design of computers and how they probably couldn't symbolize or recognize infinity that we human beings build into our systems in a variety of ways.
Oh, I didn't know you did this.
We never talked about this.
No, this is cool.
But the first chapter of this thesis was called From Aristotle to the Computer, with the logical design of computers, but the last chapter was called God. And I realized, okay, now I, like you, and now I need to go to seminary.
Did you ever talk, we're totally on a great tangent here, did you ever talk to Don Knuth?
To whom?
Don Knuth at Stanford?
Not really, no. I mean, I know.
Okay. He's the father of computer science. He wrote the Bible of computer programming. He's the founder of computer programming as a discipline, really. But anyway, he wrote a book called Things Computer Scientists Rarely Talk About.
God's one of them.
Yeah, he's a lay theologian, Lutheran guy. But he wrote about this number called Super K, which is generated by this very simple algorithm he came up with, which he describes in his book. And it's just, you know, this gargantuan number. And basically says, who needs an infinite God when you can have a number that big? And generated on a computer. He says, with a number that big, what's infinity? It's nothing.
But of course, as George Cantor would tell those of you who are interested in this arcane subject of transfinite numbers, no matter how big the number gets, it's still no closer to infinity than the number one. And those kinds of things really became fascinating to me. You can't reach that wall until you cover half the distance and half the remaining distance and half the remaining distance. You can never reach that wall. Well, if you run the series to infinity, you can. So it's those kinds of things that I got.
That got you going.
That got me going.
I didn't know you wrote a paper. That's great. This is great. Oh, sorry. This is where we go. So God. So you would say natural God as opposed to supernatural God?
Yes. Yes. I think the idea of a supernatural God that somehow intervenes and changes the natural laws of the universe, that gravity now but not tomorrow, you know, I can jump off a tall building and somehow angels will bear me up. I don't think so. So the idea of a supernatural God became meaningless to me.
At what point would you say that?
Well, I guess starting with my atheism. I mean, that was the end of it. And as I built my understanding of God back up, it always had to be something that had logical, scientific, rational basis.
Can't go at that point.
As well as, you know, the emotional engagement in concepts like love and great music and art and myth and stories and so on. I mean, that's all part of religion. But to say that there is a supernaturally intervening person, especially one with a long white beard, seemed not penetrable to me.
Well, I think as you've pointed out, my own experience too in my career, it's always very interesting to have non-Christians tell us what Christianity is, isn't it?
It is.
It came out in your book here, the public atheists the last several years kind of telling you, Scotty,
what
Christianity is.
Yeah, you can't be a Christian if you have these beliefs. And in fact, you're an atheist. You know, you may think you've evolved from that with these signs of transcendence and so on, but from our perspective, Dan Dennett does say this, if you have those kinds of beliefs, you must be an atheist. Yeah. Now, of course, conservative Christians often say the same thing.
Right.
If you don't believe in the kinds of doctrines of a virgin birth of Jesus and a photographable resurrection and the reality of miracles, etc., you can't be a Christian. And we read your book and we say, well, that's a nice book, but the man is not a Christian.
Yeah, so you somehow have to find a gracious way of responding to this. And I think one of the things that I was very taken by, just, you know, I think it reflects who you are as a person, is a great generosity of spirit here toward these atheists, public atheists that you describe or that you respond to in the book, you know, that there's a willingness that you show in the book to learn from them. There are things that they have to teach us as Christians.
Tremendous amount. I mean, that's it. It's really important because they're telling us things like Christianity is responsible for a lot of violence and bigotry and irrationality, ruining a lot of science education in our schools, et cetera. And they're right about that. We really need to take a look at Christianity, no matter what kind of Christian we describe ourselves as, and face up to those realities. They're telling us that, as Dan Dennett often says, the irrationality of this tradition is really problematic, and you liberals are just helping it. And perhaps the worst, we can maybe deal with conservatives who are saying things that we do think are clearly irrational, but you're putting a veneer of respectability over Christianity, which allows it to go on and do the violence and create the bigotry and misunderstanding and so on. So you're really more responsible for the horrors of religion than the conservatives.
So we're codependents, according to these folks. Yeah. So what do we do about this codependence? How do we?
Well, I think
answer the atheists on that point?
Well, again, it's important for us, I believe, to engage in dialogue both with the atheists who have a lot to say to us and to conservative Christians who remind us of the power of symbols and ritual and scripture and religious experience, people who tell us of their born-again experiences, the closeness of God to them in their lives, who read scripture not just rationally, but see it as having real power in their lives and so on. We need to listen as liberals both to the atheists and to the conservative Christians, and we certainly need to be listening to the other religions of the world, what they can teach us. Christian prayer can be so enhanced by an understanding of Buddhist and Hindu meditation by yoga. Mm-hmm. Our understanding of our variety of rituals can be so enhanced of fasting. How do Muslims fast during Ramadan? What is the power of that? Why do some Jews keep kosher? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Really can help us in our own spiritual lives. So it seems to me obvious that we have to keep our ears open and empathetically listen and learn from other traditions, but also name the problems with these traditions that put our entire planet at risk.
So, in a way, you feel like you have an extra dose of responsibility. If you're going to be a Christian at all, you have a heavy responsibility to address the problems that the atheists point out, the earth-threatening problems, simply as a matter of responsibility, because who else is going to do it? How heavy of a responsibility does that feel to you?
I think it's a pretty heavy responsibility, because I think given the things that religion can do, I can gear up each year and do a sermon on the subject of, does religion do more harm than good? And I think that's still an open question. And I think we need to remain engaged within each of our traditions to name those parts that are inhumane, that are damaging to other people, that cause discrimination and bigotry, and that are ultimately violent in many cases. The holy wars, the pogroms, the inquisitions, the witch trials that we've been responsible for.
And another thing that I found in the book very useful was what were your examples of social issues, environmental issues, et cetera, and taking a Christian approach to a solution or a position or a take on that issue, but from within the faith.
Right.
It seems to me a lot of us who call ourselves progressive or liberal Christians, very often we use arguments that are kind of exogenous to our religious tradition. But you know, like the piece you did on abortion, I thought was extremely useful. And maybe you could talk a little bit about Christian thinking about social issues what's your calculus for sorting that out?
You know? Yeah. Well, we do need to take, we're Christian, we need to take the Bible seriously. Yeah. We need to take the tradition of Christianity and its history seriously. I don't like the pick and choose approach to Christianity or to any religion. Or picking from a variety of religions and piecing them together into your own religion. So I do see myself very much on a path of this tradition, trying to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And if you take abortion, for example, Jesus never says a thing about abortion. And Jesus lived in a time where the scripture that he was using, the Hebrew Bible, around abortion, spoke of the story in the Torah of a woman being hit in her stomach by a man in a fight, and the fetus being killed, and her having a miscarriage. And now what's the responsibility of the person who kicked her in the stomach? And the result in the story in the Torah is that he had to pay a fine. There was no notion that the fetus was a human being, was a person, that this was murder, that this was homicide, that it was manslaughter, any of those notions of a human being. So the rabbis actually in the Talmud, some years after Jesus, used that passage as a basis for saying that you're not an Adam, a person, until birth. Mm-hmm. That's the critical moment. You take the first breath of life, then we have personhood. And the Supreme Court in the Roe v. Wade decision points out that there have been many different religious perspectives on when personhood or human life begins, and that we live in a pluralistic society, and there's many Jews and many Christians who see potential life, mm-hmm, of a fetus, but not human life, so that you would be calling the death of a fetus murder. And we need in this pluralistic society to respect people's choice. And it's a matter of religious freedom and a matter of all the other First Amendment freedoms of freedom of speech and freedom, mm-hmm, of association and so on. So my position on abortion is, let us, in each of our religious traditions, with our very different perspectives on when human life begins, have the freedom to make those choices. Now, I do think we should work hard to reduce the incidence of abortion. That's, mm-hmm, problematic. And as Hillary Clinton has said, abortion should be legal and rare. And there's lots of things we can do to reduce the incidence of abortion. But it's a tragic situation I think we've gotten ourselves into as a nation, where we're trying to legislate that matter and say that people who don't see a fetus as a human being can be condemned as murderers.
Mm-hmm. And I was struck, you know, in your argument that it was really a helpful timeline of the perspective of the Catholic Church on this matter, all the way up till Thomas Aquinas. There was no stricture against abortion outright. You know, Aquinas looked at identifiability as the criteria, as
actually
opposed to even viability. Yeah,
all the way up until the mid-1800s, when finally a pope, using actually modern scientific understanding at that point, said the critical moment is conception. Uh-huh. But until then, there had been notions of quickening, when you first feel the fetus, uh-huh, move, or ensoulment at, early it was said to be about probably around 40 days, but later, by the time of Aquinas, around 116 days. So the Catholic Church, for most of its history, had not seen abortion as the killing of a human being. So it's a fairly recent development in Catholic theology.
Mm-hmm. To Jesus. How do you look at the character of Jesus? You know, we have the historical Jesus, search for the historical Jesus, the Jesus Seminar, Westar Institute's approach. How much do you look at it the way they do? Would you consider yourself a Jesus Seminar guy in that department, or do you deviate in any way with that school of thought? Or
I think what the Jesus Seminar is doing is very important. It's trying to look at the gospel, the Gospels, and say what were the likely true words of Jesus, and what is it that has been added by the early church to what Jesus actually said or did, and try to separate that out so that we get some sense of who the historical Jesus really was. And of course, there is a lot that the early church did. It was facing persecution in some cases. It was some of these writings were before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD or 70 of the Common Era. Some were before. Paul writing about the year 50. John writing probably around the year 100. Jesus having died around the year 30. Mm-hmm. So these are being written much later and solving problems for the early church. And the question is how much of this was put into the canon of the New Testament that may not have been the actual words or action or the behavior of Jesus. So I think it's a very useful approach, and I try to follow what the Jesus Seminar has taught.
But I guess the question is there, and this is something I wrestle with, it's like there's the historical Jesus. You know, there probably was a real person named Jesus. There are certain things that historically if we look at, the canon of history, what's considered historically correct or true or likely to be true in the case of Jesus. So there's that, which I find very useful. But I also find the parts of the New Testament that aren't historical, that the Jesus Seminar has written in black. It's black means didn't happen. Gray means almost certainly didn't happen. Pink means might have happened. Red means it happened. Very little of the Jesus Seminar Bible is red. So what about the rest of it? What do you do with the rest of it?
Well, I mean,
with the black parts.
Exactly. Well, but this is really important because this is what the early church, how it was thinking and how it was developing and how they were struggling with the life of this man and what it meant to them as they developed this new Christian community.
So Christianity is more than Jesus for you.
Absolutely. Okay. And you how think so? Of what Paul, Paul is really the great teacher of Christianity as he went out to the Gentile world. Jesus was a Jew, a Palestinian Jew, probably never imagined himself as anything else. He obviously was very open to people of other traditions, to Roman soldiers, to tax collectors, to these hated foreigners of different religions, the Samaritans up north and so on. But the early church is very important. I mean, the whole Bible is telling us of people's understanding of their relationship to God. So we can't be throwing that all out by just making it black letter.
But there are parts of it you'd throw out.
I wouldn't throw out any. I think one has to study the Bible seriously as a whole. That's the beauty of the Christian lectionary. We're forced on a 3-year cycle to read through the Gospels and through the epistles of Paul. And
you follow that?
I do.
Amazing.
I preach from the lectionary.
Well, you're better than I am. I do the selectionary. I just pick out what I like. Well, you're more of a... That's amazing. The guy's a Unitarian, and he's more Orthodox than I am. Marvelous.
Well, I think it's a wonderful discipline because we get to look at the whole Bible. I mean, not everything is ultimately in the lectionary, but there's tough things that are said there that I, as a Unitarian or as a liberal Christian, have to struggle with. Yeah. You know, Jesus says most of the time things like turn the other cheek and blessed are the peacemakers, but other times he says things like, I come not to bring peace, but a sword, and divide brother from sister. Well, that's in the lectionary this Sunday. How do I deal with that? I go to my commentaries. I try to figure out what the early Christian community was dealing with at the time, and so on. And I realize Jesus was saying to early Christians, this is not going to be easy for you to follow me. And you may find your family members turning against you, and you may find yourself at risk of your own life and so on. I think that's what he meant, not, you know, I come to divide people. But if you follow me, this will be difficult for you, and you may find yourself divided from others. But he was clearly, again and again, you have to look at the Bible as a whole, the New Testament as a whole, a person with a radical message of love, of openness, of tolerance. He's the one who tells us when you ask, who is my brother? He turns to this example of the hated foreigner, the Samaritan. We now use that as a positive word, but it was a very negative word in Jesus' time. To say, people of my own religious tradition, this priest and this Levite, walk by this bloodied man. But who helps the bloodied man? The Samaritan. That's the true neighbor. And so Jesus was always reaching out to with a very generous vision. And a pluralistic attitude, he didn't have to take somebody from another religious tradition for that story.
Is Varun here? There he is. Varun Soni, Dean of Religious Life, my boss at USC. And Varin likes to say that what progressive Christianity is all about is turning is getting Christians to think like Hindus about their religion. You know, it's like, what are there in Hindu tradition? 333 million avatars or manifestations, not avatars, but manifestations of Brahman, right? So there's this built-in pluralism in that religion, and obviously you picked that up when you were in India.
Right, and that's why I sometimes call myself a Hindu Christian.
Yeah,
with apologies to Hindus who say, "Come on, of course you're not a Hindu." But I'm very impressed by that tradition in its openness to all the other religions and India's history of incorporating and embracing insights as they came into the subcontinent from all traditions.
Did you ever read Abhishekdananda? I think he was a Belgian priest who went to India and did Christian monasticism, Hindu style, took on a Sanskrit name and did it the Hindu way, but as a Christian monastic.
Oh.
I don't know. It's just, so there is some tradition, there is some history to this.
Right.
But yeah, that's part of your, but okay. Apropos of that, how have you discovered ways of interpreting Christianity, interpreting the Bible from people who practice different religions at Stanford, or at Tufts?
Yeah. Well, it's been tremendously helpful to be in a position as a dean for religious life, as both of you know, where we are rubbing shoulders, elbows, you know, whatever, with people every day from a wide variety of traditions. And as I was mentioning earlier, my Christianity is enhanced as I learn about fasting traditions from others or meditation traditions from other religions. And I'm challenged often, both by people of other traditions, but also by other Christians, to look at issues like we mentioned abortion or homosexuality in a time of Proposition 8, or issues around war. Are we, as Christians, required to oppose the Iraq war or not? What about torture? How could our nation have legal justification for torture? What's the Christian perspective on that? And as I speak with people of other traditions and from other countries, it's a challenge to look at those questions directly and try to come up with what I feel is a conscientious Christian answer.
I remember when the Iraq War was brewing, and you called together a gathering to look at the just war theory, mm-hmm. from Catholicism,
and I was impressed.
I was impressed that a Unitarian, doing Augustine's just war theory. Who knew that such Unitarians existed? So I was impressed by that.
Well, I think Christianity has had three approaches to war. It's had a pacifist history, especially in the first 300 years before the Roman Empire became, with Constantine, Christian. And then it had, starting with Constantine and Augustine and some of those teachers, a just war theory. And then later a less attractive theory of crusade. So I don't think there are too many Christians who maintain the crusade understanding anymore, but
they're around, and
pacifism is a minority tradition. You know, the Quakers, the Mennonites, there's a number of historic peace churches, and I do consider myself a pacifist and in that nonviolent tradition of Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi, to speak of Hindus. But the mainstream position in Christianity is a just war perspective. And before the Iraq War, we had statements from the Vatican and from virtually every mainline Christian group saying it simply doesn't meet the just war criteria of Christianity. So I preached on that subject after this meeting that you describe and was able to get an article in the San Francisco Chronicle just ticking through the just war theories and saying we actually don't fulfill a single one of those criteria. And I think it's important for Christians to speak up from their moral perspective and their religious perspective and say, what kind of political implications does this have? Mm-hmm. And torture is one which is even more clear historically for all Christians. And I consider it very important for us to speak out against torture on the basis of our Christian understanding, especially given that our Savior, Christ, was horribly tortured and then executed in this most inhumane way on a cross.
Of course, that raises a whole bunch of thorny theological issues, doesn't it? How are we looking at the crucifixion? Are we looking at it as salvific, or are we looking at it, we're looking at it theologically, or are we looking at it as a political consequence of a man who stirred up the people and caused a ruckus and threatened the Roman Empire?
Well, there have been a lot historically that have followed when we speak of martyrs in the Christian tradition. Martin Luther King Jr., when you speak out and live your Christianity in society, you do it at risk of your life. And going back to Hinduism, of course, that was true for Gandhi as well. He was a very devout Hindu and ultimately killed by an Orthodox, a much more conservative Hindu, because he was too open to Muslims. And so that is the risk that you face.
Question, on campus, how are things changing, staying the same? What changes do you see in the religious landscape of the university through your time at Tufts and also now at Stanford, a good run of time, almost a decade?
It's really changed a lot. I started doing this work in the early 1980s. And the pluralism on campus, the multicultural reality that we have is stunning by comparison. And also I think the recognition on secular campuses that religion is important. When I first went to Tufts, there were many professors who wondered, why would we hire and pay a university chaplain at a secular university? And I don't get those kinds of questions anymore. People are really hungry to learn about religion, about spirituality, to understand the variety of traditions and how they think about the world, and to have good relations with people who call themselves atheists and humanists and agnostics. We have a new group on campus at Stanford called AHA, with an exclamation mark. That stands for Atheists, Humanists, and Agnostics.
Let's remember that, Varun. We got to start that.
And I'm really pleased that they now get the first place in the A's in our list of religious groups on campus, although we had a little struggle with them about whether they wanted to be part of Stanford Associated Religions. I tried to help them see that we interpret the word religion very broadly. But now they're the A's. So we go from atheists to Zoroastrians and get the A to Z swing there, although we did actually, our Zoroastrian group is currently not operating, so we go from atheists to Unitarian Universalists.
I think it's these folks' turn now to have a chat with you. Scotty, let's open it up. This gentleman right down here, yes?
In your thinking, where do you put the Book of Revelation and the eschaton?
Right. So the Book of Revelation is one of several books, both in the New Testament, you think of Daniel and some of the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible books, which see us as right on the edge of the end time, and that's going to happen very, very soon. So sometimes I think Revelation is overemphasized by those who want to think of us in the end time, and there have been many groups which actually have sold all their goods, and they're, gotten completely ready for the end time, and then it hasn't ended. And there's a psychologist at Stanford, Leo Festinger, who coined a theory that now I think is in common parlance of cognitive dissonance for these groups that think it's that history will end and then it doesn't. And how do you put those two realities together, the one that you hold very strongly religiously and then the reality that it didn't happen? So Revelation is a fascinating, to me, symbolic, mythological book with a lot of wonderful, powerful imagery, because I think it was written just after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and the sense that will the Roman Empire prevail or fall and so on. So a lot of it's quite interpretable, I think, in terms of the political realities of the time it was written.
Please, down
Hi.
Hi.
As you were talking earlier about like the human law of love and the example of Jesus with the outcast, I was thinking about Rene Girard, who I believe is at Stanford, maybe, who wrote about the human tendency to scapegoat, to form social groups and pick an outcast. And looking at religions and comparing them, he deduced that Jesus was the only example he could find who aligned voluntarily with the scapegoat. And I'm wondering, I don't know, if you compare the New Testament to, I guess, the way Christianity is practiced today, I'm wondering if you have a theory on where that went, the idea of social justice.
Okay, let me see if I can answer that adequately. The notion of Jesus as the sacrificial lamb, of course, is central to a lot of the imagery of the Mass, of the way Jesus is referred to. And I think the notion of Jesus as scapegoat is quite interesting and quite powerful in the history of Christianity. There obviously have been other scapegoats, and we can work our way through them. Here are the Jewish people, the whole tradition that Jesus grew out of, the Exodus experience and so on, a people that have been scapegoated again and again. So I think that's an important concept. I'm trying to relate it to your concern about, or your question about what I was saying earlier. Help me a little bit in terms of, am I getting it all into your question? Here comes the mic back.
The idea of being liberal or like aligning with the outcast or the scapegoat, I mean, we could pick social groups like the homeless or people struggling with poverty or whatever. Right. The idea that Jesus would have, as a leader, voluntarily aligned with the group that is being targeted by those in power.
Right.
Where do you think that concept kind of went as time went on? Why is Christianity not associated with kind of social justice, social.
Right. Well, I think clearly Christianity, you're absolutely right. That was what Jesus did. That is how he aligned himself, always with the marginalized, with, as I said, from prostitutes and lepers and hated foreigners, including the representatives of the Roman Empire and so on. So that is very much what this tradition is about. It's what liberation theology of the Catholic Church in Latin America, the preferential option for the poor, is all about. It's what Black liberation theology has been about and what Martin Luther King and others were talking about in the civil rights movement. It's absolutely central to who Jesus is, what the Christian tradition is all about. And to the extent that that's been ignored, or to the extent to which Christianity has aligned itself with the status quo or with the power of the state, as it has, say, in Latin America, where liberation theology said that the Catholic Church is too aligned with governments rather than with the people. Or there's lots of examples, including what's happened in the United States at many times. Our presidents all pray in the name of God and say, God bless you and God bless America, as they end their speeches. Those statements, God bless America, and God shed his grace on thee, and all of that, those are actually prophetic statements. They're not statements that God does bless America or God does shed his grace on America. It's saying, may God bless America. Because of all the things that we've obviously done so wrong, we need to be called to account. When it says, may God shed his or her grace on thee. And those are critical prophetic statements. And perhaps what happened, what went wrong with Christianity in this vein, is that it became the religion of the Roman Empire with Constantine and then became aligned with the government in many ways since.
And Scotty covers this waterfront very nicely in his chapters here. So about the great social issues and church and state, et cetera. Yes, please. Down here.
I'm a proud atheist, but I still like you.
I appreciate that. But I'm I like you.
Thank you.
Aha.
I'm curious that most of the major religions have historically and to this day devalued, subjugated women. And do you think that there will come a day where there'll be a reckoning of the religions with how women have been and should be treated in a modern society?
Well, we're coming. I mean, of course there has to be a reckoning. It's a travesty that half of humanity has been treated the way it has, by not only in Christianity, but other religions, and the whole patriarchal reality of so much of religion. I don't think we can let all of atheist and atheist ideologies off the hook on that either, but I don't want to go there right now because I'm speaking about Christianity. And Jesus actually was, I think, one of the people who really helped us in this regard by having women who were close to him. You look at the gospel account of the resurrection, who's the first witness to the resurrection? And as Augustine called her, the apostle to the apostles, but Mary Magdalene, who hasn't necessarily gotten a very good rap in a variety of ways, including the claim that she was a prostitute, which there's no biblical evidence for, and so on. But yes, it's absolutely critical that we have women in equal positions in the leadership of our religious organizations. And the first clergy, ordained clergy, that was accepted by a denominational organization, I'm pleased to say, was in my tradition, in the Unitarian, well, actually the Universalist Church in the 1850s. There's a claim by the United Church of Christ, Jim's tradition, that actually they were ahead of us in the late 1840s, but the woman who was ordained was by a local church, and then that wasn't upheld by her association. But anyway,
right.
It's critical.
We were a close second.
So I hope I'm answering your question to say, of course, the treatment of women is a critical liberation issue for a church which has been unfortunately patriarchal.
Others, please. Oh, good, down here.
Yes, I'm an atheist too, but I'm a Jewish atheist. And I explain it to my students, and I don't see any problem there. I think my Judaism is a cultural group, and that's how I see your Christianity. It's not your religion. It's your cultural identity. Do you see it that way, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that religion has always been intermingled with culture, with a sense of identity, a sense of a people, particularly true in Judaism, but also certainly in Hinduism. I mean, there is no Hinduism. It's the religion of India, and it's tremendously diverse and so on. And there's people within, I'd say, virtually all traditions, certainly the Buddhist tradition, many would say they're atheists. And the Buddha, in his sermon, early sermons at Sarnath in India, said, don't speculate about God. Live your life now and do your meditation, which is the way to respond to the suffering in the world. So there are many Christians who might say adopt the notion of being atheist or agnostic or humanist, but still insist on their being Christian. It's hard, though, in Christianity, and I think in Islam, because these traditions have been very quick to push people away within their own traditions if they don't have the proper doctrinal claim according to the person who's... And it's true in Judaism, too. I mean, there's lots of rabbis that might say, you really can't be a Jewish atheist. But the reality is there's lots of Jewish atheists, and Judaism is very much a cultural tradition, not just a religious tradition.
And it might help also to remember that when the... Christian religion first started, the early Christians were accused of atheism because they didn't worship the gods. And there was a misapprehension of what it meant to be a theist in the context of Christianity in that culture at that time. So it seems like we're always having a healthy dance about this topic and an interesting relationship with the whole idea of atheism throughout the history of our religion. I mean, you think about Judaism also with the idea of God's name being unutterable. Orthodox Jews refer to God as Hashem, the name. You can't even describe, you can't even use the name, you just say the word name. So it's like it's a certain kind of, it might be seen by some as a certain kind of atheism.
Or
built into the religion.
Adding to some other traditions, what do Muslims say every day? The first thing they say five times a day in prayer, there is no God except God. So the importance...
Yeah, that's cool. I never thought... That's great.
The importance of recognizing, first of all, don't make idols out of things that aren't God. And what do Hindus often say? Neti, neti, neti. Not this, not this, not this, not this. You know, don't confuse, as we often do, you know, material success or sex or whatever you might with God, with the ultimate. If you don't want to call it God, call it that which is most important. That's what should be most important, with real capital B beauty, real capital T truth, etc.
St. John of the Cross, the journey up Mount Carmel, nada, 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 nothing, nothing. Yes, please.
Maybe I'm missing something here, but it seems to me you've talked and around and around and around. Of what sort of liberalism is Jesus guilty?
Let me read you just the very first paragraph of this book. Wasn't Jesus a liberal? Asked an evangelical Southern Baptist preacher named Gary Vance before the 2004 U.S. election. A year later, he wrote, I was saddened by the responses from the religious right. They made bitter and vitriolic diatribes that questioned my credibility as a minister and my standing in the kingdom of God. The values that he referred to as of liberalism included belief in progress, tolerance, individual freedom, and the essential goodness of humanity. So those are the kinds of values that religious liberals, Christian liberals have stood for. And I also write a little bit later in this book about the other side of your question, what is a conservative Christian? Christian conservatives, by contrast, have tended to uphold religious tradition rather than opposing the authority of religious tradition, insisted on the teaching authority of the church over individual conscience, prioritized belief over reason, often talking about leaps of faith or blind faith, accentuated original sin over the notion that we were created in the image of God and have very positive dimensions to our being, and stressed that history is ultimately in the hands of God rather than our being able to make progress ourselves as human beings. Christian liberals have prized tolerance, while Christian conservatives have given priority to truth. So when I often get in arguments with Christian conservatives, they say, well, you can talk about love all you want, but ultimately truth is the primary value. So I hope that it helps.
Back there, yes. Right here.
Actually, this builds on that last question because I wanted to hear some more about the reaction to your views from the religious right. I know from my experience when I've spoken to people on the religious right about my faith as a non-fundamentalist Christian, they just tend to shut down. They just do not want to listen to me. Atheists may disagree with me, but they're at least curious to know what I believe and why I believe it, whereas the fundamentalist side of Christians I find just plain shut down. So when you talk about building bridges to all sides of the cultural divide, you know, the other side, frankly, wants to blow it up. So, you know, I'm just wondering, how have you dealt with them, and have you had more success in getting some of them at least to take you seriously?
They're not proselytizing well if they shut you down, if they just stop the conversation. I mean, the conversation should keep going. I find a lot of Christian conservatives want to keep talking to me to help me, and ultimately to pray for me if they can't help me. So, and I take that seriously. I mean, I think that my mother prayed for me until the day she died because she was worried for my eternal soul. So I take that seriously, and I appreciate her prayers because she may be right on this, and I may be wrong, and I may need those prayers. So I try to engage Christian conservatives as I would atheists, and trying to listen carefully to their understanding, their knowledge of their perspective of the on the world, on God, on Jesus, and see what I can learn. I love the Hindu myth or story of the blind men at the elephant, where they are all, nobody can see the whole elephant, the elephant being a symbol for God, of course, but somebody's holding on to the tusk and they say God is cold and hard, and somebody else has their hand in the mouth and they say no, God is warm and wet, and somebody else, or the elephant, sorry, somebody else holding the tail, they say the elephant's like a broom, and they argue with each other all the time. And none of them are going to get the whole picture because we're finite and God is infinite, or they're blind and the elephant's bigger than they are. But if we would listen to each other empathetically and try to learn from each other, maybe we get a better idea of the elephant. And there's something to learn from many quarters.
Yeah.
I have read your book, and I find it to be a clear, compelling, historic argument for Jesus being a liberal. Yet your book title is considered provocative. So my question is, how did conservative Jesus become the dominant Jesus of the late 20th and early 21st centuries?
Well,
a bit of that's in the book.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think really what happened was in America, a radical shift from when I was in college, where the public voice of Christianity was what we were talking about before, standing by marginalized people, liberation theology, Martin Luther King Jr., anti-war movement. A lot of this was, standing for women's rights, for gay and lesbian rights, et cetera, et cetera. That was the public face of Christianity. And I was arguing in college with Christian conservatives who were saying, you have no right to be saying anything in public about religion. Religion is a private matter. Render under Caesar what is Caesar's. And there's no place. In fact, you're being anti-Christian by bringing your Christianity into the public arena and somehow apparently associating it with politics. And Jerry Falwell was one of the main purveyors of that message, that religion is between me and God and my personal salvation. 1979, Christian Coalition, Moral Majority, his organization he started, and then later Pat Robertson, the Christian Coalition, they turned that around, and evangelical and conservative Christians, fundamentalist Christians, came into the public arena very effectively using a lot of the methods of the civil rights movement and so on. And with conservative politics of the time during the Reagan administration and later, they were able to create a condition where now my Stanford students, as they enter, have an understanding of Christianity as only conservative. They think all Christians have to be anti-abortion, all Christians have to be against gay marriage, all Christians, you know, it goes on and on. And it was very effective organizing, both on the part of some religious organizations like the Christian Coalition and the Moral Majority, and the alignment with the political realities of the day, and the fact that the Republican Party also aligned itself in many ways with Christian conservatives in order to win votes. So it's quite a success story for the religious right.
Sure. Just on that topic, what's the name of the book by Ballmer, Randy Ballmer's book that covers that history so well? What's the name of it?
Don't know, Jim. Sorry.
B-A-L-L-M-E-R. Read him on that topic. Yes, back here.
I think my question piggybacks on the previous question. On the political front, I'm curious about where you see the Christian right heading, in which direction. And I say this in light of the fact that the current president seems to have a more pluralistic, it seems to me, approach to speaking about religion, and more diverse, I think, understanding of that. So where do you see the Christian right, how do you see it moving? Is it, like, will it solidify even more in sort of in the face of such a president who seems to kind of advocate for that more pluralistic perspective?
It might, you would think theoretically, but I see the evidence going the other way. That is, we do have now a liberal Christian president. And I could, you know, say more about that if necessary, but I think he fulfills the criteria that I speak about for liberal Christianity. But evangelical Christianity is not a monolith, and it has all kinds of different dimensions, from the African-American church to Pentecostalists to to fundamentalists, to people who call themselves progressive evangelicals like Jim Wallace, to the emergent church, which tries to link conservative and liberal Christians together. There's just a wide variety, and I think I see more of a fraying of the religious right, or less sense of solidity as a voting bloc and having an orthodoxy. I see Christianity in general being loosened up quite substantially, and hopefully we'll have more dialogue now between the Christian right and the Christian left, of which I consider myself part, and of which I consider Barack Obama part.
Do you see that happening? Do you see that change on campus with the evangelical students? Do you see any changes in that community of young people at Stanford?
Yes, I think I'm finding the evangelical community on Stanford to be incredibly diverse. We have more than half of our 35 groups on campus are evangelical, but they are very, very different from each other in many cases. And they're doing a lot of really good work with the marginalized and the poor, and responding to New Orleans and responding to Haiti, and there's building coalitions with liberals and with non-religious people and people of other traditions to try to respond to social justice and social service needs. So yeah, I think it's different. I think we need a last question here. Let's see one way in the back. If there's
back there.
Could you elaborate on and I hope clarify your statement that you don't like the pick and choose approach that some Christians have to Christianity, or that adherents of other religions have to their own religions, or even those by those who seek to assemble their own faiths from more than one religion?
Yes. I think it's, if we look at a spiritual mountain that we're all trying to climb, or a lot of us are trying to climb, I think it's most effective to try to climb that mountain along these well-trodden, well-established paths of the major religions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, etc. And when you sort of strike out on your own and you try to pick and choose elements from one religion and put some yoga together here with some Jewish Kabbalah there and some Sufi dance here, etc., I think that it's like people trying to climb a mountain by bushwhacking their way up, and often you get caught in the brambles or you start going around in circles. It's better to have traveling companions on these large paths. And within the path, I think you need to take your scripture and your history and so on seriously. That's why I was saying I try to follow the Christian lectionary and not pick and choose particular passages, Bible passages, to say these are the important ones and the others aren't. I think I need to struggle with the whole text rather than trying to pick and choose. And I was actually quite surprised in talking to some friends recently in evangelical Bible churches who I assumed followed the lectionary or went through the whole Bible because they're Bible churches. They said, no, we don't follow lectionary. We have certain passages that are most important to us, and those are the ones we tend to emphasize, and we don't follow the lectionary and look at the whole Bible. So that's, to me, to be conscientious as a Christian, you want to struggle with the whole tradition, its history, its rituals, its doctrines, its scripture.
Thank you all. Thank you, Scotty.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.